Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is going to be a weekly docket. And if you have not heard our weekly dockets before, the weekly docket is where I just cover the top five true crime stories for the week. So our first story is actually going to be a continuation of a story that we covered last week, and it's the case out of Washington State that is as heartbreaking as it is disturbing and frightening. Picture this, a father takes his three young daughters on a camping trip, and by the end of the weekend, all three girls are dead, and the father has vanished into the wilderness. This is the reality that has gripped the Wenatchee area for the past 2 weeks, as 32-year-old Travis Decker, who is an Army veteran and survivalist, remains on the run accused of murdering his own children. So let's back up to how this all started. Over Memorial Day weekend, Decker had a scheduled visitation with his daughters, Peyton, who's 9, Evelyn, who's 8, and Olivia, who's 5. He was supposed to return them to their mother, his ex-wife, in Wenatchee on May 30th, but he never showed up. So alarmed, the mother contacted police that evening, and then a massive search kicked off, and 2 days later, on June 1st, authorities made the grim discovery near a remote campground in the Okanogan Wenatchee National Forest. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. But Travis Decker's pickup truck was found abandoned and nearby. The bodies of all three girls were located down an embankment. Now, I've heard conflicting reports. I've heard that they were found in the vehicle, and I've heard that they were
down the embankment. So I think some of the details that we know are either muddied or scarce because there is still a very active investigation and search going on. But the scene was horrific. According to court documents, each child had a plastic bag over her head and signs that her wrists had been zip tied. There were plastic zip ties and other debris that were just kind of scattered around the area, and blood evidence was collected from the truck. An autopsy later confirmed what investigators feared. The cause of death was suffocation, and of course, the manner of death was homicide. Now, as you can imagine, the discovery of three murdered children sent shockwaves through the community and the entire state and eventually the entire country. Washington's own governor even stepped in, releasing emergency funds and calling up National Guard resources to aid in the search for Travis. The U.S. Marshals Service posted a $20,000 reward for information leading to his arrest, and multiple agencies, local, state, federal, even neighboring counties, have been involved in what's been described as an extensive manhunt across hundreds of square miles. Now, Travis Decker isn't just any fugitive. He's a former Army infantryman with extensive wilderness training. In fact, authorities revealed once he spent over 2 months living off the grid in the backwoods. So this is someone who knows how to survive in tough conditions and potentially evade capture, which makes the manhunt especially challenging. The search area is really rugged. Much of western Chelan County is mountainous forest with pretty limited road access. I think 87% of it has no roads at all. But despite that, the sheriff has been adamant that Travis cannot hide forever. And he said, quote, "He is surrounded. Washington State knows who he is. Eventually, he's going to tire and he is going to make a mistake," end quote. Over the past several days, there has been a few potential sightings and developments in the case. One of the biggest leads came from a popular hiking area in the Cascade Mountains known as Kolchuk Lake in the Enchantments. Now, a couple of hikers reported seeing a lone man who seemed oddly ill-prepared for the terrain, like not dressed or equipped like the typical backpacker that you see on these trails. And this raised suspicions. So when a helicopter search team flew over that area, they did spot someone who promptly took off running to avoid being seen. Searchers later found footprints and tracks leading to the Ingalls Creek trailhead near a rural community called Valley High. So authorities are pretty confident that this individual was Travis Decker. It fits with where they believed he might be heading, but they're cautious about conclusively saying so until they have him in custody. Late that night on June 9th, officials put out an alert to residents around Ingalls Creek and Valley High to lock their doors and stay vigilant, signaling that they believe Travis Decker could be in that vicinity. Now, how terrifying is that? When I first heard about this story, I thought for sure he was just going to take himself out and they were going to find him dead somewhere. But the fact that there's been sightings of him and that he is still on the run is just so eerie. And I cannot imagine living in that area knowing that he could be in your backyard. Now, with that lead, the search efforts shifted slightly. By June 11th, about 12 days into the manhunt, Sheriff Morrison announced that they were adjusting their tactics. After nearly 2 weeks of intensive ground searches involving drones, canine units, helicopters, and officers trudging through rough wilderness, some resources were being redirected. The sheriff said that his team would focus more on the investigative side, preparing the case for prosecution, while federal partners like the marshals would continue the active pursuit on the ground. He emphasized this did not mean they were giving up or slowing down, just that they needed to rotate their personnel who has gotten really weary and bring in fresh resources or, quote, wave two of the search, if that makes sense. In Morrison's words, he said, quote, "We have not given up, but you've got to be perfect every single day, Travis. We only have to be perfect one day," end quote. And that quote just gives me chills. It's both a warning to Travis and a promise to the community that they will eventually get their guy, dead or alive. Hopefully alive, because he should have to face the consequences and accountability for what he has done. But as we've seen in the past, like with Brian Laundry, I would not be surprised if this coward who was willing to take the life of his three little girls would just take his own life to avoid having to face the consequences. But meanwhile, the public has been on high alert. Authorities have urged anyone in the region, especially campers, hikers, and folks with remote cabins, to keep an eye out. They've asked people to check their trail cams and security cameras for any sign of Decker, and to report anything strange like missing food from cabins or disturbed campsites. There's concern that he might be breaking into empty vacation homes or campsites to steal supplies, which was a tactic that a previous fugitive used in a similar wilderness manhunt in Washington. Now, locals in the Shelton County have really stepped up. The sheriff publicly thanked the 80,000 residents in the county for basically being their extra eyes out on the trails and the back roads. And this case has gone international at this point, with Travis's face and story being shared as far away as Australia and Portugal on social media. So it's really become a worldwide effort at this point to track him down. But let's not lose sight of the tragedy at the heart of this, because three innocent girls have been killed by their own father. Their family and the whole community are mourning an unimaginable loss. And in a poignant moment at a press conference, Sheriff Morrison asked the public to keep their names in your mind, referring to the girls, and to help bring justice back for those young ladies. He revealed that the family prefers that the victims be remembered simply as the girls. And then he did identify them, Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia. And those names really drive home that these were real children, daughters, sisters, classmates, whose lives were taken in a horrific, unimaginable way. Like, it just gives me chills all over my body because I cannot believe people like this exist. But the community held vigils for them, and there's an outpouring of grief and anger and just a desire to see Travis brought to justice for what he has done. Now, as for why this happened, that, of course, remains a haunting question. Why does anybody do the things that they do? But investigators haven't publicly speculated on a motive. The sheriff actually said, quote, "I don't think the motive would even matter. Three young girls have been killed. I don't think the motive's going to matter," end quote. So still, some background has come out through court documents. Travis's ex-wife told police that he had been struggling with his mental health, diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, and she wasn't sure if he was taking his meds. It sounds like he probably wasn't. And in one more chilling detail, at the crime scene, investigators found Travis's dog wandering nearby unharmed. So the dog was turned over to a humane society for further care. And it's a small thing, but it's just stuck in my mind that there's this pet that was apparently one of the positives in his life. And Travis had told his ex that his children and his dog were his two big positives, apparently. And he'd even talked about giving the dog up due to financial problems. The dog ended up alone at the campsite, almost as if Travis abandoned everything and everyone in his life that night. But it is odd to me that he would spare the dog's life and yet not his three daughters. So as of now, Travis Decker remains a fugitive. The latest official word as of June 11th is that the search is still active, but just taking a new form, with federal marshals using a rapidly advancing manhunt program to bring in more resources. Authorities are warning the public not to approach him if spotted. He's considered dangerous and possibly armed. They say he's likely armed with just wilderness gear rather than firearms, but you just never know. And the community is on edge, but determined. Law enforcement is exhausted, but resolute. And the Chief Jerome Brown of the U.S. Marshals said, quote, "We will not stop. We will keep going. He just has to make one mistake. He will be brought to justice so the community can heal." Now, this story is ongoing, and we will keep following it. It seems like it's a race against time to capture a man accused of the most unthinkable crime, murdering his own children. And every day he's out there is another day of fear for the public. But the sheriff said it best, comparing this manhunt to fighting a wildfire. You just have to stay on it relentlessly, but you also have to rotate the crews to keep them fresh. So they're not giving up. Hopefully by the next weekly docket, we will be able to tell you that Travis Decker has been found and taken into custody, and that a measure of justice is on its way for Peyton, Evelyn, and Olivia. Now, our next story reads like a horror film scenario. A young woman goes on a first date, and by the next day, she's not only dead, but her body has been dismembered and scattered. It's the case of Maxwell Anderson, who was 34 years old, who just this past week was found guilty on all charges for the murder of 19-year-old Sade Robinson, a girl that he met and went on a date with in Milwaukee. The case has so many layers of tragedy and just gruesomeness that it captivated the courtroom for weeks. So I'm going to break down exactly what happened and how the trial unfolded. So let's start with the night of the crime, which was April 1st of 2024. Sade Robinson was a teenager, just 19 years old, and according to what came out in court, she had met Maxwell Anderson and agreed to go out with him for what should have been a fun evening. They reportedly went to a restaurant bar called Duke's, which was a local spot for their date. Later that night, Sade accompanied Maxwell back to his house, and sadly, the prosecutor told the jury that after leaving Duke's and going to the defendant's house, Sade would never be seen alive again. At some point in the late night or early hours of April 2nd, prosecutors say Maxwell Anderson killed Sade Robinson and then took extraordinary measures to cover it up. Now, what do we know about the murder itself? Well, disturbingly, Anderson dismembered Sade's body, literally cut her remains into pieces, and then tried to dispose of them in various locations so that she could essentially disappear without a trace. In fact, a hiker stumbled upon a severed human leg on a beach along Lake Michigan, which turned out to be Sade's leg. Can you even imagine being a hiker that just stumbles upon a complete human leg, like up to the hip, just laying on the ground? I cannot imagine the horror of that. But that discovery set off alarms and then led police on a wider search. And over time, other parts of Sade's body were found in different areas of Wisconsin and even across the state line in Illinois. It's believed Anderson dumped some remains in Lake Michigan, which would carry them somewhere else, of course, and be incredibly impossible to find. And then to make matters worse, Anderson also took Sade's car and tried to destroy evidence by setting the car on fire in a park. Her vehicle was later found torched in Milwaukee, a blatant attempt to just obliterate any forensic clues and make it look like Sade vanished due to some accident or maybe even another perpetrator. So, of course, when Sade didn't come home and then pieces of her car and body started turning up, an investigation honed in on Maxwell Anderson very quickly. He was the last person known to be with her. And one big question was, how exactly did he kill her? Interestingly, the exact cause of death was never definitively determined, or at least not presented at trial, because her remains were found in such a state and possibly not all together. There was no obvious gunshot or stab wound because of the condition of her body, so the prosecution didn't have a murder weapon to show the jury, and Anderson had apparently cleaned up the crime scene well because investigators found no significant blood evidence in his home, despite thoroughly testing for it. This presented a huge challenge because this was pretty much a circumstantial case, meaning prosecutors had to piece together a narrative from indirect evidence, since there were no eyewitnesses or confession or clear forensics like DNA or blood at the house. But piece it together they did. During the trial, which took place in Milwaukee County Court, jurors heard about a string of incriminating evidence that pointed squarely to Anderson. Perhaps most damning were some photos found on Anderson's phone, deeply disturbing images that he had taken and then later deleted, though forensic techs were able to recover them, on the night of the date. One of the images showed Sade face down on Anderson's living room couch with a man's hand, presumably Anderson's, visible and grabbing her inappropriately while she appeared either unconscious or worse. A police witness testified that they couldn't tell if Sade was alive or dead in that photo, but either scenario is just chilling. If she was alive, she was incapacitated and being assaulted, and if she was dead, it's photographic evidence of Anderson with her body, and that image alone must have just made the jury's blood run cold. Another key piece of evidence was surveillance and location data tracing Sade's car's movements on the night of April 1st through the 2nd. Investigators used traffic cameras, maybe doorbell cameras, and cell phone GPS data to track where her car went after leaving the bar. They showed that the car, with presumably Anderson driving, went to his house, which matched what would happen on a date. But then later in the middle of the night, her car was seen traveling to a place called Warnemont Park. Now, Warnemont Park is a large park area along the lakeshore. That's where prosecutors say Anderson took Sade's body to dismember and dispose of her remains in the early hours of April 2nd. Surveillance video also caught Maxwell Anderson on a city bus the next morning, which was suspicious because why is he suddenly taking a bus? Well, it turns out the bus pickup was near the location where Sade's burning car had been spotted in the distance. So the narrative, of course, is that he dumped the body parts in the park, set her car on fire to destroy the evidence, and then hopped on a bus to get away from the scene. It's literally like something out of a crime drama, except it is horribly, horribly real. The trial testimony was often graphic and emotionally draining. Sade's family and friends packed the courtroom, at times breaking down in tears, hearing what happened to her. At one point, Sade's mother shouted out and called Anderson the devil during testimony. The grief and anger just overflowed, and the judge had to pause proceedings to maintain order in the courtroom. The forensic details were gruesome. Jurors saw photos of dismembered remains, heard about how a chainsaw or sharp tool must have been used, though the exact tool was never found, and how meticulously Anderson tried to cover his tracks. They also learned that Anderson tried to incinerate evidence. Aside from burning the car, he likely attempted to destroy his clothing or other items. In fact, one of the charges against him was arson, specifically arson of property other than a building, which referred to torching Sade's car to hide the crime. So let's talk about the charges. Maxwell Anderson was charged with 4 counts, and ultimately the jury convicted him on all 4. And those counts were first-degree intentional homicide, mutilating a corpse, arson, and hiding a corpse. After a 2-week trial full of evidence and dozens of witnesses, the jury took only 47 minutes to deliberate and reach those guilty verdicts. And that is virtually no time at all. Like, I don't know if you've ever served on a jury before, but I have. And I served on a jury in regards to like an insurance case, like if this guy was due his money from this. It was a long story. It doesn't even matter. But it was a lot less than a murder trial, right? Like a lot less intense. And we took probably 2 hours to come to a unanimous verdict. And so when you think about the fact that this jury only took about 45 minutes to deliberate and reach those guilty verdicts on all counts, that is virtually no time at all. And it just indicates that the evidence was so overwhelming to them, despite it being circumstantial, and there was little doubt in their minds about what happened. They didn't need proof to believe that Maxwell did this. And so I'm very grateful for that aspect when it comes to Sade's family. And I just pray that they can eventually, find peace after this. I don't know. You surely never get over something like this. I actually just finished listening to Sharon Roach's book about Lacey Peterson. I know we've talked about the Lacey Peterson case before, and I talked about how the case was largely circumstantial and why some people might still have doubts about Scott Peterson's guilt. But after listening to Sharon's book, which I implore anybody to do, you can actually listen to it on Spotify if you have Spotify. But the book is so so visceral that I was almost in tears by the end. I mean, full body chills, and I felt like I should go back and delete that episode that I had about the Scott Peterson trial, because now there really is no doubt in my mind that he did it. I can understand why people had doubts, but once you listen to this book and you get so much more insider knowledge from Sharon herself, Lacey's own mom, I just feel like it gives you a totally different perspective and a very important one as well. So I can't imagine how Sade's family is doing, and I just pray to God that this is, you know, the first step towards finding peace, is the fact that he was found guilty and he now faces a mandatory life sentence for the murder conviction. So in Wisconsin, first-degree intentional homicide carries life in prison. The only question is whether there's any chance of parole. So the judge will decide at sentencing, which is scheduled for August 15th, whether Anderson will ever be eligible for release or if it's life without parole. And given the heinous nature of this crime, I wouldn't bet on him getting a parole possibility, but that's just, I guess, for the judge to determine. And if you want to follow up on this case, let me know in the comments on Spotify or on Instagram, or you can let me know at mamamystery.com. Now for our third story, imagine being held prisoner in your own home for months, abused and terrified, and thinking you might never escape until you get a daring chance at a local sandwich shop that leads to your freedom. It sounds like a thriller movie plot, but it really happened in Florida just last week. A 29-year-old woman in Navarre, Florida, which is in the Florida Panhandle, was rescued from captivity after she slipped a note begging for help to an employee at a Jersey Mike's sandwich shop. The details of this are wild, so let's dive in with a timeline of just how this all unfolded. The victim's name has not been released, and she's understandably being kept anonymous, but we do know that she was being held against her will for several months by her boyfriend, a man named Jordan Blake Williams, who's 34 years old. Now, Jordan is not just any guy. I mean, who would be after holding their girlfriend captive for months? But he's actually a local professional wrestler who performs under the stage name Jaden Steele. You would think a wrestler named Steele would be a character in the ring, but apparently he was an absolute monster at home. According to the victim, he had repeatedly beaten her, threatened her with weapons, and kept her isolated from the world for months. We're talking about serious domestic violence, the kind that could have easily ended in her death if nothing was done. She reportedly suffered broken bones and other injuries during this nightmare, and all of them went untreated. Now, how did she manage to get a note out? This is the remarkable part. On one of the days in late May, Jordan Williams took her with him to a Jersey Mike's sub shop in Navarre. Perhaps he let her tag along to get food, thinking he had control over her and that nothing would happen in the public. But in the bathroom of that Jersey Mike's, this woman seized what might have been her only opportunity to survive. She scribbled a desperate handwritten note and then hid it in the bathroom in hopes that somebody would find it. And someone did. Eleanor Coffey, a young employee at the sandwich shop, was cleaning the restroom when she found a small, crumpled up piece of paper shoved near the toilet paper dispenser. At first glance, she thought it was trash. And can you imagine if she would have just thrown it away? I mean, who knows what would have happened? Probably she would have been killed. But thankfully, she was curious enough to open it. Inside, she found a chilling plea. In shaky writing, the note said something along the lines of, "Please help me. I'm at this address in Navarre. I need you to call the police and do a wellness check." It even provided the specific address where she was being held captive. One version of the note, per an arrest report, was even more urgent, reportedly saying, "Please help me get home." And then, "Help," in all caps, "get me before May 30th. Now think about that. She was essentially putting a deadline, fearing that perhaps by May 30th, she knew something terrible would happen to her, like maybe he had threatened to kill her or move her somewhere else by then. The note also mentioned that William's parents were helping him keep her in the home, which is just a whole nother layer of disturbing if that is true. So Eleanor immediately knew that this was serious. She and her coworkers didn't just shrug it off. They called the Santa Rosa County Sheriff's Office right away. Deputies actually rushed to the Jersey Mike's to collect the note and any other information. And smartly, they also reviewed the store's surveillance video to see who had been in the bathroom around that time. Sure enough, they saw footage of a woman and a man entering the store together and the woman going to the restroom. From prior domestic incident records, deputies already had a clue. The man looked like Jordan Williams, someone who unfortunately was already on their radar from previous domestic disturbance calls involving the same woman. So yes, there had been multiple past police calls for domestic violence with Jordan, which makes this even more heartbreaking that the abuse had been happening and known to some extent, but just hadn't been stopped yet. So with the note's address in hand, the sheriff's office did not waste a second. They organized a team to do a welfare check and rescue operation that very night. So this was Tuesday, May 28th, going into early Wednesday. They obtained a search warrant for the address. They wanted to go in with authority. And early on Wednesday, May 29th, deputies stormed the home identified in the note. Inside, they found exactly what they feared. A 29-year-old victim was there, alive, but in really bad shape. She immediately confirmed to the deputies that she was the one who wrote the distress note. The fact that she was even still there indicates that after leaving Jersey Mike's, Jordan had brought her straight back to the house and thankfully oblivious to the fact that his girlfriend had just outsmarted him and set a rescue operation in motion. The deputies arrested Jordan Williams on the spot at the house. He did not put up a fight from what we know. It was a relatively straightforward arrest once they had him by surprise. And given the situation, the charges piled on quickly. Jordan has been charged with a slew of felonies: aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, kidnapping, false imprisonment, felony battery, misdemeanor battery, and battery by strangulation. So essentially, they threw the book at him, which is completely appropriate. Kidnapping and false imprisonment, covering the holding her captive part, the various battery charges cover the beatings, and the strangulation charge is notable because strangulation in domestic violence is often a predictor of potentially lethal intent. So Jordan Williams was booked into the Santa Rosa County Jail on Thursday, May 29th, and the judge ordered that he be held without bond. That means he's not getting out of jail while he's awaiting his trial. He stays locked up, which the irony there is not lost on me and likely not lost on his victim either. I suspect he'll be facing a long prison term if he's convicted on those charges. Kidnapping alone can carry decades. But let's talk about the hero of this story, the note and the Jersey Mike's employee. Eleanor Coffey, the worker who found the note, spoke to the media, and frankly, she is a rock star. She recalled finding that crumpled piece of paper and reading the desperate message. And because of her quick thinking and compassion, this victim is free today. And this victim is also a hero in her own story, because I cannot imagine how terrifying it would be to try and escape knowing that you're risking your life to save your own life. The weight of that is impossible for any of us to imagine unless we've ever been in that situation. This story, fortunately, has a positive ending. A woman's life was likely saved, but it's also a reminder of how critical small actions by bystanders can be. So I've started ending my episodes with stay curious, because you should always be asking questions, always trying to find more information, and also stay vigilant, not only for your own safety, but for the safety of others. And so the fact that Eleanor Coffey stayed vigilant helped save this victim's life. Also, to anyone out there in an abusive situation, there are ways to signal for help. We've heard stories of victims sending notes through Grubhub or DoorDash or slipping pharmacists' notes. And in this case, the restroom note worked. Many places like restaurants or bars have trained staff to recognize signals or code words from people in danger. So for example, asking for an angel shot at a bar is a known code for I need help, bad date. Like if you're on a blind date or a first date and you get really bad vibes, you can order an angel shot and they will help you like end the date peacefully and separate you from the date, right? So the victim here did exactly what she had to do in her circumstances, and it worked. After the rescue, the sheriff's office in their press release also reminded the public, if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse, please, please reach out, even if it is to a complete stranger. Now for our final story, we are going to do a recap on the Karen Reed trial. I started out when this trial started, what feels like years ago. I started doing updates on a daily basis, or I tried to anyway. And then it got to be a lot, especially with my kids getting out of school and we have summer camps all the time. And it's a lot. And so I didn't want each day to kind of get lost in the shuffle of all the other episodes, which is why at the end of the week, I intend to just kind of recap the week at the end of the weekly dockets so that you're still getting Karen Reed trial coverage, but it's just a little bit easier on me. So anyway, this week was really big. There was so much that happened. And so I'm going to tell you all about it. And then yesterday, the defense actually rested their case. So a verdict is coming soon, you guys. I think what's left is for them to do their closing arguments and then hand the case over to the jury. So hopefully it doesn't take long to get that verdict. And I'm hoping that by next week's weekly docket, we will have a verdict. But anyway, let me tell you what happened this week. First, we have to talk about the sweatshirt cut controversy, so the hoodie holes. This was the jaw-dropper moment of the trial and directly relates to John O'Keefe's clothing. So John was found wearing a t-shirt and a hooded sweatshirt or hoodie. The back of the sweatshirt had a couple round holes and tears in it. So during the trial, when the defense was presenting their accident reconstruction expert, which I'll talk more about him in a second, but prosecutor Hank Brennan dramatically suggested to the jury that those holes in the sweatshirt could have been caused by the impact of Karen's vehicle, like evidence of a collision. So this was meant to counter the defense's argument that the injuries didn't match a car hit. Well, the defense attorneys immediately blew the whistle on this because they had documentation that those holes were not from any accident at all. They were cut by a state criminalist, a forensic lab tech, as part of examining the clothing. So in other words, a lab tech had cut out pieces of the sweatshirt for testing, leaving clean holes. The jurors didn't know that until the defense loudly objected. So the defense attorney, Robert Alessi, was furious. He basically accused the prosecution of deliberately trying to mislead the jury by implying that the holes were crash-related, when in fact, the Commonwealth's own forensic files showed that the holes were man-made during analysis. Alessi called it a stunt and even moved for a mistrial with prejudice right then and there, claiming that the state was manufacturing evidence and that this was an irremediable, this is a hard word to say, irremediable situation. He used that word. Now, this was high drama in the courtroom. Alessi was pounding the lectern. His voice was raised. He's basically saying the prosecution was so desperate that they tried to pull a fast one. The prosecutor, Brennan, had to sheepishly admit that it appears I made a mistake. And then, of course, Judge Bev did not grant a mistrial, which would have blown up the whole trial and just started over yet again, which is a huge deal. So in one way, it's like a good thing that she didn't. But in another, it's kind of like no surprise because she seems to be so biased during this whole trial. So instead, she gave a curative instruction to the jury, clarifying that the holes in the sweatshirt were indeed from the lab cutting them, not from the night of January 29th, 2022. She even let the defense hold up the hoodie in front of the jury to underscore the point and set the record straight. So the jurors got that loud and clear, but it was certainly an ugly moment for the prosecution. Intentionally or not, it looked like they either didn't do their homework on their own evidence or they were trying to do something sneaky. And the defense jumped on this to argue, see, the state has no case. They're trying to invent collision evidence that doesn't exist. So another big part of the defense's case was trying to show that John O'Keefe's injuries, particularly some wounds on his arms, were not consistent with being hit by a vehicle, but were consistent with a dog attack. So they brought in a forensic pathologist named Dr. Marie Russell, who is something of an expert on dog bite wounds. She testified that the pattern of injuries on John's forearm looked like they could be caused by a dog's mouth, bites, and scratches, rather than by scraping on pavement or glass from a taillight. The judge allowed her testimony. The state tried to block it pre-trial, saying that she wasn't qualified, but thankfully they failed. And Dr. Russell told the jury essentially that, in her medical opinion, John's arm had multiple small wounds that matched dog teeth, spacing, and claw marks, more than they matched injuries from being struck by a car or lying in the glass. And yes, I'm saying glass because they're suggesting that he was holding a glass in his hand and that the shattered pieces of the glass could have torn into his shirt. So I know it sounds like I'm saying grass, but not. Anyway, the prosecution, of course, fought back on this. They cross-examined her on her credentials, pointing out that she's an ER doctor and pathologist, but not a veterinary expert specifically, though she had published on dog bites before. They tried to downplay the dog bite theory as speculative. However, the defense also had their main medical expert, Dr. Elizabeth LaPosada, a former state medical examiner, ready to say that the overall injuries did not line up with a typical car and pedestrian impact, and that hypothermia contributed to the death. So I'm going to play a sound clip from the court, from the trial itself of Dr. LaPosada. And I loved her when she was on the stand. So I'm going to play a few clips because she just does it best. You have to hear it straight from her.
He did not die of hypothermia.
And is that opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Based on your overall review of the medical records associated with Mr. O'Keefe, were you able to reach an opinion and conclusion as to the cause of death of Mr. O'Keefe?
Yes.
What is that opinion?
He died of brain injuries and skull fractures due to blunt force trauma of the head.
Do you have an opinion as to whether or not the wounds that you see, the patterned injury that you see on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm, is consistent with an animal bite or claw marks?
Yes, it is. Very much.
Thank you.
The defense went on to say that the homeowner's German Shepherd, Chloe, which was in the house that night, might have attacked John either during a fight or when he was unconscious outside. They pointed out that John had a couple of cuts on his arm and a black eye and some head lacerations that, in their view, weren't caused by a simple backward fall or one slow-speed car bump. There was even mention that an eyewitness saw the dog with blood on its paw that night, although I'm not sure if the jury actually heard that directly or if it was just in defense motions, but it's obviously a sensational claim, that the dog did it. But then it was the prosecution's turn to cross-examine Dr. LaPosada, and so here is how that went, essentially. And listen to what she says and the pause with Hank Brennan, because I think she totally took his breath away. Just listen.
Did you look, when you were doing your differential diagnosis, did you look at any evidence other than physical evidence? Did you look at any data evidence?
I don't know what you mean, data.
Like data you'd find on a cell phone?
No.
Did you look at any of the data evidence from the defendant's Lexus?
No, other than looking at the contours of the back to see if it had impacted Mr. O'Keefe.
When you were doing differential diagnosis, did you look at any information that would tell you what the speed of that impact may have been or allegedly was?
Well, it didn't hit him, so it doesn't matter.
Okay. So you didn't care to know anything about the car or the data in the car because you had already formed your opinion?
It did not hit him, so it was not relevant to my opinion.
Is that
By looking at the body, I could tell that there was no evidence of impact with a vehicle. Whether the vehicle was going slow or fast is not relevant.
And so you didn't try to get any information about the speed of the vehicle? It was totally irrelevant to you?
Correct.
And did you also disregard... let me ask you, do you ever look at statements?
I look at witness statements if they're available to me.
Were any of the defendants' statements made available to you?
I did hear some of them.
Did you consider the ones that you heard?
Of course.
Which ones did you hear?
I really can't answer that. I don't know what you'd have to give me an example.
You had never had a chance to go out to that scene yourself, did you?
No, I just looked at all the photographs.
You cannot see what's under the grass and the dirt, can you?
Well, dirt's under the grass.
Well,
I just love her. I love how she just tells it like it is. And Hank Brennan was like, okay. But I love that the jury got to hear that, because I just think it is so incredibly important to hear from an expert, a doctor, a medical doctor, that this does not line up with a car versus human impact. So on the prosecution side, they had their own accident reconstruction expert who testified earlier that the physics showed Karen's car could have struck John and caused certain injuries. But the defense brought in the big guns from ARCA, a firm that does crash tests. So two experts from ARCA, Dr. Daniel Wolf, now he's an engineer, he's the one with the dimples that everyone is like swooning over on TikTok. And then there was Dr. Andrew Rentschler, who is a biomechanical engineer. These were called by the defense. These guys literally did crash simulations with instrumented dummies to replicate a scenario of the Lexus backing into a human. They essentially wanted to see if the impacts and injuries line up with John's actual injuries. Now, if you'll remember last week, Dr. Wolf testified that in their tests, when a dummy was hit by a car at similar low speed, the dummy's clothing got some road rash or abrasions and tears. But crucially, the damage to the dummy and clothing did not match John O'Keefe's pattern of injuries. He noted that John's arm didn't have fractures, which you would expect if a car shattered a taillight against it, and that the scrapes on John's arms were relatively minor. There was no broken bones, just scratches. So Dr. Rentschler echoed that if the SUV whacked John O'Keefe hard enough to break a taillight, then it should have broken his arm or caused much more severe trauma, which it didn't. Dr. Rentschler quantified it, saying that the forces would have been well above levels where you would get fractures. Thousands of pounds of force traveling at, they're suggesting, 25 or 26 miles per hour, and yet John's x-rays showed no fractures in that arm, or in his other arm for that matter, or anywhere on his hips or legs or anywhere else. Like, you would just expect there to be some broken bones if you're hit by a freaking car going 25 miles per hour. But okay, a tense moment was on cross when Prosecutor Brennan tried to pick apart Wolf's dummy experiments. And he noted that Dr. Wolf used a certain weighted dummy arm that might not perfectly match a real 6'1", 216-pound arms man's weight. So they bickered over percentages and whether using a dummy to predict tears in clothing is scientifically kosher. Hank Brennan suggested there's literature saying that you shouldn't do that, but Dr. Wolf stood his ground and even pointed out that the state's expert did similar extrapolations with dummy data. And let's not forget, he did it with that blue oil paint backing the car up at 2 miles per hour. So tell me which one is more believable or better to describe the actual scene. This guy who is the same height and weight as John O'Keefe with blue paint all over the taillight rubbing up against the taillight, or a crash dummy that's actually hit at 25 miles per hour like the state is suggesting. Essentially, at the end of their testimony, the point was that the physics don't add up to Karen hitting John. If she did, his injuries would be different and worse in a lot of ways. Now, as of the latest update, the defense rested on June 11th, and surprisingly, the prosecution declined to call any rebuttal witnesses. They had signaled they might rebut the defense experts with some of their own, but after seeing the defense's case, they chose not to. That means all the evidence is in, and it is time for closing arguments. Notably, this trial has been heavily watched, even live streamed, and has a lot of public interest because of the drama and the notion of a police cover-up. Outside the courthouse, Karen Reed has had vocal supporters rallying for her, literally standing with signs, albeit silently due to court rules. She told reporters that she feels her case this time was stronger than the first trial, having put more evidence and witnesses forward. The jury will soon deliberate on whether she's guilty of second-degree murder or any of the lesser charges. If convicted, she faces life in prison with the possibility of parole after a term of years, since it's second degree, not first. If acquitted, her saga ends as a wrongfully accused in her telling who exposed a bigger scandal. There's also the possibility of another hung jury, but given all that's transpired, I suspect the jury will try hard to reach a consensus this time. Now, this trial has been one for the books with its CSI versus conspiracy vibes, key bombshells to remember like the sweatshirt hole fiasco that led to a jury correction, the dog bite expert suggesting alternative causes of injuries, and of course the revelation that the lead investigator's bias was clearly there via ugly text. I'm kind of surprised that they never did call Trooper Michael Proctor to the stand, but needless to say, the text still made it to the jury, so they got to see what he was saying about Karen Reed and just exactly how biased he was from the get-go. All of that said, I'll say that this case has divided a lot of people following it. Some are absolutely convinced Karen Reed is innocent and that this is a big cover-up, and there are online groups dissecting every single detail, pointing out things like a Google search for the misspelled word hospital that was on someone's phone that night, suggesting someone at the house considered taking John to a hospital possibly, and that was a fact that did come out earlier. And then others believe the simplest explanation, that this is a drunk driving tragedy. The jury's verdict, which we expect perhaps within the next week or so, will finally bring some resolution. If they acquit, it'll validate the defense's crusade and raise serious questions about the initial investigation. And if they convict, then it means 12 people were sure that the cover-up theory was just smoke and that Karen Reed is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But one thing is for sure, this trial has had all the drama, so many twists and turns. Like, I feel like we're watching a movie. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is this rumor that Brian Higgins signed a proffer agreement for the FBI. There isn't anything confirmed or reputable information showing that Brian Higgins has signed a proffer agreement with the FBI. Most of what's being shared online has yet to be substantiated, and the trustworthy news outlets that are covering the Karen Reed trial haven't reported anything official about this. But just so you know, a proffer agreement is when someone signs this agreement with federal authorities. They're essentially giving testimony or information in exchange for negotiated protection, like immunity or a limited deal. So it's important to distinguish this from a full-fledged plea or immunity. A proffer is just the initial step, which is often tied to cooperation in an investigation. Now, there are a few social media posts on like Facebook, TikTok, and Reddit threads that claim Brian Higgins signed a proffer and is cooperating with the FBI, some suggesting full immunity. But these are unverified rumors based on speculation within the online Justice for Karen like groups and community, I guess. But none cite official filings, court documents, or mainstream media sources. It is possible that the FBI has interviewed or questioned witnesses, including Higgins, given his status as a federal agent and obviously his close ties to this case. Like, he is the one that is rumored to be having, not even rumored, it's proven that he had an inappropriate relationship with Karen while she was with John O'Keefe. And some suspect that that could have been part of the motive as to why John O'Keefe was killed that night, if they are on the side that Karen is innocent. But anyway, it's possible the FBI has interviewed or questioned him, but that's substantially different from securing a formal proffer agreement. Investigators routinely speak with people tied to a case. Unless there's a court filing or official statement confirming a proffer, it remains to be speculation. If it is true, though, it definitely suggests that there's something we don't know, and it bolsters the theory that the defense has been suggesting this entire time. So if it ever comes out that there actually was a proffer signed by Brian Higgins, or if this trial doesn't end in the Commonwealth's favor and there's another investigation that happens, I will surely follow it and let you all know. But that is it for today. I will see you next week for the weekly docket. Please send me case suggestions or recommendations if you have stories that you'd like me to cover. I just got a recommendation earlier this week for the next deep dive that will be on Tuesday's episode. So I really do appreciate it. It's like a group effort, a team effort to keep this podcast going. And I really appreciate it. So if you liked this episode, share it on your social media, share it with a friend, leave us a review, leave us a comment, do all the things. Stay vigilant, stay curious. Mama Mystery out. Have a great weekend. I love you so much. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.